From the heartland of America and the gateway to the West, good morning, good evening, wherever you may be across the nation, around the world. I'm George Norrie, and welcome to Coast AM. Later on tonight, Evidence of Eternity. Make sure you're around for that part of the program. And by the way, I trust those of you who celebrate Easter and Passover had a great time. Here's what's happening. A volcano on Alaska's Aleutian Islands erupted Sunday afternoon, sending ash some 20,000 feet into the air. The U.S. Geological Survey reported that the Pavlov volcano is located about 600 miles southwest of Anchorage. The agency says the volcano, which is about 4.4 miles in diameter, has had 40 known eruptions and is one of the most consistently active volcanoes in the Aleutian Arc. Is it a danger? Let's check in with renowned environmental consultant, Dr. Tim Ball. Tim, is this serious or not, this volcano?
Well, no, it's really not at the present time. It's part of the most active volcanic chain in the world, the Aleutian Islands. But it could have an effect upon the global temperatures in this way. It's erupting vertically into the lower stratosphere. And when the dust gets up into the lower stratosphere, mixes with the water, becomes like yellow droplets, and tends to reduce the amount of sunlight, and that's a factor. But because the air, it's winter time, and the stratosphere is actually much lower at this time of year, that's why this dust is getting up there at that altitude. So the combination of that, but it also adds to what's called the dust veil index, which is the general level of dust, volcanic dust in the atmosphere at any given time. And as I say, it will add to the reduction of sunlight very slightly.
The other thing that concerns me, Tim, is the possibility of severe earthquakes along the western side of the United States. What do you hear these days?
Well, it's actually been relatively quiet. What a lot of people don't realize is that the more earthquakes you have, the small ones, the better, because that means that the plates are moving by each other, and it's when the plates get locked up, that is, these crusts of the earth that lock together, but the movement keeps going, but they're not moving, and then they suddenly jump, and of course that's what you're looking at with San Francisco. But the level of volcanic activity or earthquake activity around this Great Ring of Fire has been relatively within normal ranges. And as I say, lots of earthquakes are a good thing. It's when they don't occur, that's when you got to start worrying.
Okay, Tim, thank you so much. Dr. Tim Ball. Easter, Pakistan. Islamist militants in Punjab, the country's richest and most populous province. An Easter Day bombing, killing 70 people, injuring 300, many of them women and children. Christians simply wanting to celebrate Easter in Pakistan. ISIS, by the way, has apparently killed an Indian Catholic priest, kidnapped in Yemen earlier this month. They say he's been crucified. And they're also saying these days that they plan to kidnap Israeli children and kill them as well. And Syrian antiquities experts are expressing shock at the destruction of the Islamic State group, wrought which inside Palmyra's museum. Scores of artifacts were smashed before troops drove the extremists out of that historic town. Let's check in with Dr. Jerome Corsi, noted author and writes for WND.com. Jerry, this has got to stop pretty soon, Jerry. It's getting out of hand.
It is, George, and this crucifixion of the priest, which is yet reported, it's not 100% confirmed. The Archbishop of Vienna is reporting that this Father Tom Usenal was crucified in Yemen. He was abducted out of a home for the aged that was being maintained by the Sisters of Mother Teresa in Yemen. A gunman came in, they killed four nuns, they abducted this priest, shot up and killed various of the old people in this home, and over Easter, supposedly, the priest was crucified. Now, we don't have photographs, we don't have confirmation, but it's still a chilling story, and it's again a reminder of how barbaric the ISIS terrorist can be. I mean, reintroducing crucifixion into the world, which, you know, we would like to think had been gone 2,000 years ago when Jesus Christ was crucified, and the Romans, who crucified many, many people, are that practice has hopefully died away until brought back by these ISIS terrorists with this priest. It's very terrifying.
Jerry, are these the terrorists, of course, but are they just thugs, too?
Certainly, George, they are thugs. They're completely lawless. I mean, their abduction of young women, the raping of young women by the ISIS terrorists, which is now a practice that we're seeing in Europe with the raping of women. It's one of those politically incorrect points about radical Islamic terrorism is that it's barbaric to women in general, especially women that the terrorists consider to be their rightful prey. But this crucifixion of a priest again shows the genocide that's going on in the Middle East against Christians, really wiping out Christianity in the Middle East, which is ISIS's goal, and largely unreported in the Western press, or underreported for sure.
I've got to tell you, if they start trying to kidnap Israeli children and kill them, I got to tell you, they're going to have one heck of a battle with the Israeli government.
Well, there's no doubt about that, George, and I think the Israeli government is vigilant in the protection of the Israeli people. But the determination of these ISIS terrorists, the radical Islam, to eradicate Israel, even with Iran, whom we supposedly have this nuclear agreement, firing missiles again after the agreement was signed, saying death to Israel written on the missiles. I mean, it's chilling. And the level of violence in the Middle East, I think today is the most extreme and most frightening it's ever been in my lifetime.
All right, Jerry, thank you so much. Dr. Jerry Corsi. New York's Tribeca Film Festival will not show Vaxxed, a controversial film about the MMR vaccine, that's the measles, mumps, and rubella vaccine, according to its founder, Robert De Niro, the great actor. As recently as Friday, Robert De Niro stood by his decision to include the film by anti-vaccination activist Andrew Wakefield in next month's festival. Now, the link of the film makes between the measles, mumps, and rubella vaccine and autism has been discredited by the organizers. Robert De Niro now says they will not show the film. In a class action lawsuit filed earlier this month in U.S. District Court in Columbus, Ohio, multiple men alleged that Procter & Gamble's Old Spice deodorant left them with severe skin reactions, including rashes and chemical burns. The suit seeks more than $5 million in damages, claiming that 13 Old Spice products affected hundreds, if not thousands, of consumers. A wanted North Carolina man was arrested this week on charges that he failed to return a VHS tape to a video store 14 years ago. I kid you not, 37 years old. He was driving with his daughter to school. He was pulled over by police for a broken brake light, and they ran, of course, his driver's license and told them that he had an outstanding arrest warrant for not returning a movie to a store in North Carolina 14 years ago. Up next, the world according to Jim Mars. Get ready for him next on Coast to Coast AM. Okay, welcome back to Coast, George Norrie with you. Jim Mars with us for a couple hours. Award-winning journalist, one of our favorite guests, has more than 30 years' experience with several Texas newspapers. Back in 1999, he began teaching a course on UFOs, perhaps one of the first university-level UFO courses in the nation. He's got a number of books published, including, of course, Alien Agenda, Population Control, Our Occulted History as well. And we're going to talk with Jim about a lot of things tonight, but we're going to start with an incredible case of a crashed something in 1897 in Aurora, Texas. Hey, Jim, welcome back.
Hey, George, it's always a pleasure to be with you. And looks like we're going to run into each other here before long, because I believe you're going to be at Contact in the Desert, and I believe you're going to be at UFOs Within Reach at Big Bear Lake, right?
Absolutely, and I understand that you and I may be in Dallas doing something.
Oh, later on this year, yeah. We'll keep that under our hats, because we may have some real stuff to talk about as that gets closer.
There's no question about that. Let's talk a little. We got lots to talk with you about tonight, Jim, but let's talk about this 1897 case in Aurora, Texas. Why does this case continue to really hit the headlines in the UFO community?
Well, I'll tell you why. Because number one, all through the years is I could prove it because I drew a watercolor about a UFO incident that happened in Loveland, Texas, and I still got that. I found it, so I know that I've been actively investigating, looking, and studying about UFOs since at least that incident. I went back to check on that. That was like 1957, okay? So I've been at it a pretty good while. But all through that time, you know, it's always been, well, they're just misidentified aircraft, or they're secret government test craft, or, you know. And, of course, all of that is reasonable. That's a reasonable explanation.
Sure.
So I always thought, wouldn't it be great if we had an incident of a well-documented incident of a UFO that happened before there was any man-made craft in the air? And that is Aurora, Texas, which I consider the smoking gun of the UFO issue, because this was an incident that happened on April the 19th, 1896, This was 6 years before the Wright brothers flew, and also they flew in December of 1903, and it was also in 1903 that there was the first recorded balloon flight, powered balloon flight. Of course, George, I'm sure you know that, you know, they've had balloons around for a long time. They had them in the war between the states, and they were on a line. They were on a rope. They'd just winch them up, and they'd hang there, and they'd use them for observation. So the first real powered balloon flight that moved around was the California era, and that lifted off again in 1903. So here's a case that happened 6 years before there was anything man-made in the air. And then what's amazing is that it fits into the context of what's known as the Great Airship Mystery of 1896-97. And basically what that was about was that starting about the summer of 1896, this big cigar-shaped object was sighted over Sacramento, California. And then it moved north. Almost to Seattle was seen. Then it was reported traveling across the northern part of the United States. I think it got as far east as Chicago. All through the latter part of 1896 and into 97, it was seen coming down through the Midwest, various places. And then in April, it arrived in Texas, was sighted in several places here. And then, of course, on April the 19th, it was reported crashed in the little hamlet of Aurora, Texas, which is about 20 miles northwest of Fort Worth. The Dallas papers carried the story, and it's really interesting because it said that Aurora, Texas, about 6 o'clock this morning, the early risers of Aurora were astonished at the sudden appearance of the airship, which has been sailing through the country. It was traveling due north and much nearer the earth than ever before. Evidently, some of the machinery was out of order because it was making a speed of only 10 or 12 miles an hour. And, yeah, let me stop right there. Airspeed is like 80 or 90 miles an hour. If you're in an airplane or any kind of flying craft, if you're not going about between 75 and 85, you're not going to be able to stay in the air. So this is strange right there. Said it sailed directly over the public square, and when it reached the north part of the town, collided with the tower of Judge Proctor's windmill, scattering debris over several acres of ground, wrecking the windmill, water tank, and destroying the judge's flower garden. Now here's the clincher. The pilot of the ship is supposed to have been the only one on board, and while his remains are badly disfigured, enough of the original has been picked up to show he was not an inhabitant of this world. Whoa.
Exactly. And then they buried him in some graveyard, right?
Yes. there, buried him in the Aurora Cemetery, which is still there today. It's a very old cemetery. It was began about 1861, right about the time that the war began. And there is a Texas State historical marker on the front of this cemetery talking about the spaceman that was buried there. Now, George, I got on this story back in the early 70s, and it was really fascinating to me because I wrote some stories for the paper, others did. My counterpart with the now-defunct Dallas Times-Herald was a man named Bill Case, and we wrote about it, and we said, well, you know, why don't they just exhume the grave, and we'll know for sure what's there, right?
That would be easy, except somebody did exhume it and stole it.
Well, no, they couldn't exhume. We couldn't get it exhumed. We all wrote stories and said there ought to be an exhumation, and then the Cemetery Association got up in arms, and they hired a lawyer, and they said, no, we're going to, you know, sue anyone who tries to dig up the graveyard because we don't want that, blah, blah. Okay, well, it created a little bit of stir in the Dallas-Fort Worth area, and so there were lots of thrill seekers going up there driving around. So they actually put a police guard up there. The town marshal, Pig Idell, set up on it during the daytime, and then they'd have a Wise County Sheriff deputy come up and sit up there at night. This went on for about 2 weeks, and then the very day that they pulled the police guard, the little headstone turned up missing. Okay, and it's never been seen since.
Gosh.
But, of course, I saw it, and I've even got photographs of it. And it's really interesting, George, because it was just a little sandstone rock type thing that had been chiseled out. And there was like a V-shape on its side with little circles in the middle. And I really believe that it was only half of the original headstone. And if you extrapolate that half to another half, you've got a saucer type shape with little portholes in it. And that's so it was really fascinating. But what's more fascinating is a few months after all this died down, you know, they threatened a lawsuit. We couldn't dig in the cemetery. The headstone went missing, and everybody kind of eventually lost interest. I got a call from Bill Case. He said, meet me up in the Aurora Cemetery, and I did. He had a metal detector, and he said, watch this. And because before, when we'd been up there, he had run this metal detector across the grave, and it registered three hits of metal, one near the headstone, two near the center of the grave. George, I still remember that because I was kidding with Bill Case. I said, yeah, that's probably his tricorder, you know, that thing they use in Star Trek. So this time, a few weeks after the headstone went missing, he runs a metal detector over there. The grave obviously had not been disturbed. It wasn't all dug up. And there were no readings, okay? So we got down on our hands and knees, and we found three little holes up near one near the, where the headstone had been, two in the middle of the grave. And I said, whoa, what happened here? And he said, well, I think somebody with some very sophisticated equipment came, located these bits of metal, and used a core sampler to go down there and extract the metal out of this grave. And I said, well, who do you think did that? Do you think that was UFO researchers? And he said, no, I don't think so. I knew he was going to say, and I agreed with him. He said, the UFO researchers are not going to break the law like that. He says, I think it was the government, and I do too.
And it could have been.
And it could have been, particularly since a few years later I met a woman, and something came up about the spaceman buried in the Aurora Cemetery, and she says, you know, as a little girl, I used to go play over there, and says, I ran into government agents in that graveyard. And I'm thinking, oh, yeah, I said, okay, yeah, I said, that was probably in the early 70s, right? Thinking she was referring to the time I was there investigating. She said, no, this was back in the 50s. So, see, there's been government interest in that ever since the 50s. In fact, I think you're going to find this real interesting. I have a document that was pried out of the government, and it's a memo from George C. Marshall, who was chief of staff of Roosevelt during World War II.
Mm-hmm.
And it's dated March the 5th, 1942. So this makes it just about a few days after the famous February incident over Los Angeles, the great Los Angeles.
Oh, that's right. Exactly.
Yeah, I'm sure you remember that. Well, in this memo, first off, this is pretty wild. He says, this was from Roosevelt to Marshall. It says, as indicated in my February the 26th memorandum to you regarding the air raid over Los Angeles, it's been learned from Army G2, that's intelligence, that Rear Admiral Anderson recovered unconventional unidentified airplane off the coast of California.
Hold on for a second, Jim. We'll pick that up. That's a great story, too, next on Coast to Coast AM. And welcome back to Coast, Jim Mars with us. Jim, you were talking about the episode, of course, of the lights over Los Angeles. And people, when they were shooting at that object, people could hear pings as if it were hitting something metallic. They actually heard something.
Right. And there were actually people that died in that. There were some people who died because of car wrecks, heart attacks, and stuff like that, because they had a brand new weapon at that time. It's called radar, and the public really hadn't heard much about that. They were keeping it secret, you know. But once the war started, they were really using it, and they actually had picked up these objects, several objects, coming off the Pacific, heading eastwards towards Los Angeles. And of course, this was just like a month or so after Pearl Harbor, and the whole West Coast was on high alert. Everybody had the jitters. Everybody was afraid that the Japanese might be launching an invasion of the West Coast. And that was not just sheer fantasy. Actually, a Japanese submarine had surfaced and shelled an oil refinery out on the California coast. And so they got all upset. Well, these objects came in over Los Angeles, and they began shooting at them with anti-aircraft guns about 11 at night. And this lasted well into the morning hours till 2 or so. And some of this ordnance was falling back on the city, caused some damage, et cetera. But then a day or two later, the Secretary of War announced that it was just war jitters, okay? And, of course, then the war news kept going on, and everybody tended to forget about it. But as I've got this document here from Chief of Staff George Marshall to President Roosevelt, and he was saying the War Department, Naval Intelligence, has reported an unidentified aircraft off the coast of California that had no bearing on conventional explanation. And it said further investigation revealed the Army Air Corps also recovered a similar object in the San Bernardino Mountains east of Los Angeles, which cannot be identified as conventional aircraft. Whoa, so there was really something going on. But, George, the thing that really caught my attention was down at the bottom there's a little further paragraph. And by the way, all these documents are stamped top secret. I think they've probably been declassified now, but obviously I don't want anybody here to see this. And at the very bottom, Marshall had written, I have further ordered a thorough investigation of all War Department files regarding unconventional aerial phenomenon reported since 1897, the very year
of
the Aurora spaceship crash. So I think that there were certain people at high levels of the government who knew what was going on. So I've been tracking that story ever since 73, and here's what's really fascinating is that I know back in the 70s when I first made a trip to Roswell. Roswell is actually kind of a small little town, and nobody out there at that time wanted to admit or talk about UFOs. You know, they acted like, wow, we don't know what you're talking about. And because it was just so out of the ordinary and considered so crazy by so many people. Of course, all that's changed now, right? If you go out to Roswell today, you'll find a big UFO crashed into the side of the Walmart, and there's aliens up and down the street. They finally figured out that maybe they should be capitalizing on this. Well, the reason I bring that up is because I think it's really interesting that the little town of Aurora has now set a date for April the 16th called Aurora Alien Encounter.
And
they're picking up on this, and the city is now willing to talk about it. In fact, they have a pretty good roster of people coming in to speak that day. It's only going to be a one-day event, 10 to 4. I'll be there to kick it off and show a DVD about the Aurora crash. Interestingly enough, the keynote speaker will be Travis Walton.
Oh, love the guy. He's
yeah,
super.
I know you and Walton are good friends. He's going to be there to talk about his experience as well as other UFOs. Nick Redfern, who another friend of yours and ours, mine too, is going to be talking about famous Texas UFOs other than Aurora. The cute and vivacious Tui Snyder is going to give an overview of the whole Texas airship mystery. And Stephen Androsko is going to be talking about the real cowboys and aliens, not the movie that we've seen.
Good mix of people.
Yeah, and Noe Torres, who I believe you know.
Oh, sure.
Del Rio UFO. So they've really got it lined up, and they're going to, this is cool. They're going to have it at the MD Resort, which is a really, really nice place right there in Aurora. And then they're going to have a free shuttle bus to take people at their own leisure, at their own time, to the crash site and to the cemetery where the little pilot was buried.
Is it eerie when you walk those sites thinking of what had happened years ago?
Well, it kind of has been for me, especially in the cemetery, because the cemetery is a really old cemetery. In fact, you find tombstones there, markers for Confederate war veterans, things like that. But it's really, it's a peaceful thing. It's up on a hillside, and you can see all around the countryside. That always interests me, too, because you can tell that if something's crashing to earth, it would hit at the highest point, and that's it, okay? But here's what's really wild, and I know you don't want to spend all your time on Aurora, but start back in the 70s, and I've been keeping up with that for years, and frankly, George, I've always been a little undecided. I thought there was enough going on there that indicated something must have really happened.
Mm-hmm.
But then there's, a lot of the people, they live out in the country, and they are out in the country because they wouldn't be left alone.
Well, did you have doubts?
Oh, yeah, because especially back in the 70s, spaceship crashed here? Well, what? But I'll tell you something. But then when the headstone went missing, and then when the metal in the grave went missing, and then I was able to, I was able to actually interview three old citizens there who had been there. One of them, Robbie Hansen, said, no, it didn't happen. It's just a big joke, Well, by her own account, though, she didn't even live in Aurora. She lived way outside somewhere, and her story was that somebody came by, rode by, and told her dad about it, and he laughed and said, oh, that old Judge Proctor, he's such a joker. And so based on that, she said, no, it didn't happen. It was just a hoax. But then there was Mary Evans, who was a young girl at the time, about 12, and she said she actually heard this crash, and that her parents all ran into town to see what had happened, but she was too young, they wouldn't let her go. She said, but they came back, and they were all talking about this crash and all this metal debris that had been laying all around. So that would indicate it probably really did happen. But then I actually talked to a fellow named Charlie Stevens, who actually had witnessed the whole thing. He was a young boy, about 13 or 14, and it was early in the morning, and he was out with his dad doing chores, and saw the thing going over and said it was sputtering and kind of drifting towards the earth. He said it seemed to him like it had some problem. And then he heard the crash up in town, boom, and they saw smoke going up. And this is a little bit of his story that kind of tells me he's got to be telling the truth.
That something happened. That's
yeah.
Right.
Well, here's the thing, George. If he was just making up something, what would he say? He'd say, I ran out of town. I saw a little alien. I saw this. I saw that.
Sure. No, really make it juicy.
It make it really juicy. But instead, he said he wanted to run in town, see what had happened. But his dad said, no, son, we have to finish the chores. And, being a Texan and living out in rural Texas, I can assure you in 1896, if you didn't take care of the chores, you didn't eat, So to me, that was a very real thing that they had to finish the chores. So that's the Aurora thing. And now there's been some scientific examination. They have found using ground-penetrating radar. Well, first, let me say that the debunkers have always said it was a hoax. It never happened. And therefore, there's no grave. Therefore, there's no crash debris anywhere.
Yeah, right.
And that Judge Proctor did not have a windmill, okay? Well, scientifically, we now know, because we use ground-penetrating radar, that there is a grave, a short grave at that site because the ground's disturbed at those levels, okay? We also found the footing for a windlass, which is a derrick or a tower that Judge Proctor used to operate the sump for his pump. Okay, now, so it's true, apparently he did not have a windmill on top of it, but he did have a tower, and that apparently is what the object struck. But the key thing to me is that we have found little bits of molten aluminum,
aluminum, and aluminum is not natural.
No,
to
it's
this planet.
Fabricated metal, yeah. And so you got these little BB size and little pieces of metal embedded in the trees and in rocks around the crash site. And the scientists say, well, that's an indication of a big explosion there. And I remember back in the 70s, I interviewed Brawley Oates. They own the property there. And he had been there since before 1940. And he said, there hasn't been any explosion here. So something happened before 1940. And as you said, George, aluminum, number one, what we find is the composition of this aluminum is not like aluminum produced today, all right, although it is aluminum. But also, I went and did a little bit of research on aluminum. Aluminum had only been being made like less than 10 years before 1896. And in 1896, aluminum was so rare that it cost more than gold.
Wow.
So, you know, I am now pretty convinced that there really was some sort of craft that crashed in Aurora, Texas 6 years before the Wright brothers flew. And I think it'd be a great opportunity with the city backing this thing as they are for people around Texas and North Texas area, or even some of you folks that are listening in other places, you can get down. You ought to come down for this day of and learn about the Great Aurora spaceship crash.
Somebody somewhere has the bones of a little alien.
Probably in Area 51, right?
Yeah. Somebody. You know, I've always thought, Jim, that these multi-billionaires would collect things like that, like they might have the artifacts of the Anunnaki. And
right.
I just think, you know, the Ark of the Covenant is
right.
In some guy's house.
Well, hey, we know where that is. That's in the government warehouse, right? I saw that in a movie somewhere.
Well, another Indiana Jones is coming out. You kind of remind me of him.
Yeah, by the way, I've been accused of wearing an Indiana Jones hat, but anyone who's known me for a long time realizes that Indiana Jones copied me.
That's right. You had it first.
Yeah,
Jim, we got a couple minutes, and we're going to talk again next hour and take some calls. But I want to ask you about something we're hearing, and I think you've been doing some work with this. Has our government applied for a patent on the Ebola virus vaccine and something to do with medical marijuana? I'm just hearing something weird. Why our government would be interested in a patent on this?
Right. Well, you know, we're supposed to be so scared of Ebola, and yet they're taking out a patent on certain forms of Ebola. You know, why would they want to be in charge of that? It makes me wonder. I suppose it's so that they can claim ownership so they can test some to find out, you know, how to find a cure. But the one that really gets me is that here so many states have now legalized marijuana, but the federal government still has the laws on the books against it. And yet, back in this was all the details are in my book, Population Control. Back about 2002, naming the patent holder as the Department of Health and Human Services, the government suddenly took out a patent on medical marijuana. And it's like, well, now that the government's got their fingers in it, well, then maybe they, you know, maybe that's why they relaxed a little bit on these laws. But now I see that it may even be a worse thing than we're thinking about, because now there are two large pharmaceutical corporations who have applied to the government to study medical marijuana to see that if it might indeed have some health benefits, as so many people have claimed for so many years.
Mm-hmm.
In fact, if you go back, you'll find in the early 1930s, when the federal government and Congress in their infinite stampedeness, outlawed marijuana. The only person that actually came and spoke before the Congressional Committee in favor of marijuana was a representative of the American Medical Association. And he argued, he said, hey, this has been in our pharmacopoeia for years. You know, why are you trying to outlaw it? But we could go into that whole thing.
Well, it helps fight cancer. It's got all kinds of medicinal purposes.
Exactly.
In
so now these two pharmaceutical giants have said, okay, we're going to study it to see if it's medicine. Well, now the FDA steps in and says, okay, now wait a minute. If they, if these pharmaceutical corporations are going to study it as a medicine, then it must be a drug. And therefore, you know, now it's going to be illegal now to have it because the two pharmaceutical companies are going to be trying to get a lack on it. So it's just the whole thing's insane.
Everything seems to be insane this year. Everything seems to be upside down. Are you feeling that?
Oh, yeah. Yeah. But here's the thing. Here's the good news, George, is that, you know, think back to probably the most turbulent and trying time of your life, and that was when you were a teenager, right?
Uh-huh.
And what's happening with teenagers? They're growing up, and it's a painful experience, but we all go through it, and we all get through it, and we end up being better people as adults, you know, for having to put up with those tough years of being a teenager, and I think that that's what's happening here with us as a nation. We're going through some really strange and tough things right now, but if you really look around, there's so many good things happening, so many people waking up, so many people listening to George Norrie and other people, you know. And I think on the whole, we're actually progressing. That's why something tells me we're going to see a lot of attendance at the Aurora spaceship thing on April the 19th and at the Ozarka UFO conference, which is that's coming up.
Already, that used to be put on by the late Dolores Cannon.
Exactly,
yeah.
And that's coming
God,
up on
her.
April the 8th through the 10th. And then you and I are going to be together out at Contact in the Desert. And then
we're celebrating my birthday out there.
Oh, is that the deal?
Uh-huh.
Going to have a cake?
I don't know what Tommy's got planned. He's got something planned.
Well, tell Tom that he's got to have some keg beer.
All right, we're going to come back in a moment. We'll continue chatting with Jim Mars. We'll get his take on the state of the planet, and we'll take your calls with him, too.